Strikes in Syria over the weekend designed to send a message
to the government of Bashar al-Assad: we are not going to remove you from power. And we may complain about the other ways that you're killing people, but we're not necessarily going to do anything about it.
A response to chemical weapons in Syria, but what did 100 cruise missiles accomplish? Also, as millions of people order direct-to-consumer genetic tests, are they getting the health information they need?
Well, my concern is that people don't really understand what they're ordering, and they don't understand the results when they get them.
And a well-known author on why she wrote a children's book where black boys are ghosts.
If there are 8-year-old children of color who are worried about the deaths of black boys, who are worried that they might die, then I felt it was something we needed to address.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, April 16th, 2018. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. On Friday evening, the United States, along with Britain and France, launched airstrikes against 3 Syrian targets believed to be related to Syria's chemical weapons program. But in Damascus, Syrian propaganda was in full force over the weekend, with pro-Assad demonstrators taking to the streets to support the government, and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad telling reporters he was in a good mood as he met with Russian officials. Nikki Haley, the American ambassador to the United Nations, delivered a warning at the UN Security Council on Saturday.
I spoke to the president this morning, and he said if the Syrian regime uses this poisonous gas again, the United States is locked and loaded.
Then on Sunday, Haley appeared on CBS Face the Nation and said the U.S. will also impose new sanctions against Russia for enabling Syria's use of chemical weapons. Ben Hubbard is in Beirut, where he's Middle East correspondent for The New York Times.
We know that these 3 militaries fired, you know, this was a very coordinated strike. We think it was just over 100 missiles that struck primarily 3 sites in Syria, all which the U.S. government has said were associated with Syria's chemical weapons programs. These were in and outside of the capital, Damascus, and also near the central city of Homs. These sites appear to have been completely destroyed. But, you know, sort of as we've got a little bit further away, it's been quite curious that there was no reports of anybody killed. And there was really no, we've not heard of any reported release of any toxic gases or chemicals or anything like that after the strike. And so it's really raised some questions about, okay, we destroyed these 3 facilities, but this was after, you know, numerous days of President Trump threatening to strike, which would have given the Syrians and their Russian and Iranian allies plenty of warning to get any sensitive materials or equipment out of the way, and also to get their personnel out of there. So this was very much to send a message more than it was to do any real damage or to and definitely the goal was not to, you know, change the dynamics of the wider Syrian wall. Their goal here was very much to send a message that was entirely about the issue of chemical weapons. You're not supposed to use these things. But I think that the secondary message or the implicit message in that is, you know, to the government of Bashar al-Assad, we are not going to remove you from power. And we may complain about the other ways that you're killing people, but we're not necessarily going to do anything about it.
So, Ben, the explicit and the implicit message here, you mentioned it. The president says the world has to be sent a message that chemical weapons won't be tolerated. But a lot of reporting suggests that Assad used chemical weapons as many as 50 times before the strike that precipitated this latest round of airstrikes. What red line was really crossed here if there's reason to believe he's been using chemical weapons all along?
You're exactly right. There have been dozens of reports of use of chemical weapons since the 2013 incident. I mean, the largest of which would have been last year in the village of Khan Sheikhoun, which was the last time that Trump basically said, we need to lay down this red line, and this was the last time that the United States ordered military strikes on Syria. In the meantime, both before and after that attack, we've had lots of these smaller scale, somewhat murkier attacks where a lot of them don't kill anybody. Some of them only kill a few people. They tend to not get very much media coverage because, you know, unfortunately, there's already so much death and destruction going on in Syria that an attack in one place that maybe only kills a few people is not really something that we pay a lot of attention to. But we have had this steady drumbeat of attacks. A lot of them appear to be with chlorine, which is not in and of itself a banned substance because of its importance for water purification and various other things. But we have every reason to believe that the Syrian government has found ways to use things like chlorine and perhaps other chemical substances kind of just to inspire terror in these communities that it's trying to take back from the rebels. So most of these are not incredibly well investigated because they don't kill a lot of people. And it almost, you know, some of the evidence that we have from the attack last weekend was that it was primarily chlorine that was used, and that one of the reasons it ended up becoming so deadly was really just kind of terrible circumstances, that whatever the government had dropped had landed on one building that happened to have a lot of people crowded into it because they were trying to avoid the shelling and airstrikes that were going on at the time. And that meant that the punch from these chemicals was that much stronger because these people were in an enclosed area. So, you know, there's one theory that says, well, if this particular load had come down a few meters away and landed in the street where the gas could have dispersed fairly easily or where the wind could have blown it away, then we would have seen a much, much smaller death toll, which would have meant we would have had not had these terrible photos of all of these, you know, men, women, and children sort of lying lifeless with the foam on their mouths and nostrils. And that may have meant that Trump would have not decided to do any kind of military intervention.
Right. So, Ben, everything you're suggesting says that, yes, this was meant to send a message, but that it does nothing to change the overall trajectory of the war, that Assad and the Russians basically have calculated effectively here that strikes, retaliatory strikes, are just a cost of doing business, and they will remain in power.
Yes, and I think that was very much the idea. I don't think that anybody in the American government or in the British or French governments was thinking that this was going to do any more than that. And I think, you know, again, it was calibrated to keep that from happening. So I think Syria, you know, the day after the strike or the 2 days after the strike, I think very much woke up to, in a way, the miserable status quo that it had before this entire incident happened. You know, we still have, you know, basically an international struggle for influence inside of Syria under the cover of a civil war that's, you know, sort of got the people of Syria stuck in the middle. International diplomacy after 7 years has not really found any way to bring this to an end or even very effective ways to bring down the violence on local levels. So, you know, there was a big show of force, there was a big message sent, but at the end of the day, we're really back where we started with this terrible, terrible war that nobody really knows how to stop.
Ben Hubbard, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ben Hubbard is Middle East correspondent for the New York Times, based in Beirut. Let's go to Oklahoma now, where most teachers are headed back into school today. A strike shuttered classrooms across the state for 9 days as teachers protested low wages and cuts in education spending. Some teachers are still planning to protest today, but the state's teachers union officially called for an end to the walkout Thursday after lawmakers passed a tax increase giving teachers a $6,000 raise and a boost to the education budget of about $50 million. The Oklahoma Education Association is the union in Oklahoma, and they've been asking for a $10,000 raise and an additional $200 million for education spending. Well, the union didn't get everything they asked for here, but it's not the first time teachers have gone on strike in Oklahoma. In 1990, teachers won a $6,000 raise after 4 days of strikes. Radon Musgrove has taught early childhood education in Tulsa, Oklahoma for 31 years. She joined that strike nearly 30 years ago, and she's headed back to school today after protesting in this one as well. Radon, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Well, we'll talk about 30 years ago in just a moment, Radon. You were one of the teachers who marched 110 miles from Tulsa to Oklahoma City as part of demonstrations last week. What drove you to take such a long walk?
Well, when I heard that they were going to do something so momentous, I guess, I just felt like it was something that I needed to do to prove how important this was to me. It just hit me that this was a great thing and maybe it would change some people's minds. And so I decided to do it.
Well, Radon, you're headed back to school with many teachers in Oklahoma. Some of your colleagues aren't going back to school, as you know. Do you feel like you've gotten at least the makings of a good deal here? How do you feel about the way this is turning out?
I have mixed feelings, I guess. I wish that we would not have gone back, or I understand the pressures that the superintendent or, and then I know that OEA took a vote and that said the majority of the members wanted to go back. But after 1990, I'm just afraid that things will not go forward. But I do feel like there's a lot more momentum behind the movement now than there was then.
Well, you're one of the few teachers in Oklahoma with experience on both of these protest lines. Take us back to 1990, all those years ago. Why did you go on strike back then?
Well, back then it was similar. We had overcrowding in the classrooms and the underfunding. And so House Bill 1017 that passed then, it regulated 20 to a classroom, and then kindergarten got an aide. And at that time, I was teaching kindergarten. And then it was also, you know, more funding put forward. And that helped for a while, but it seemed like that was all that happened then. But they were willing to work with us more, the legislators. And we were off 4 days and then marched on the Capitol. And in that one day, we got that bill passed.
Well, Radon, there was no social media back then. What was it like, the environment? Was it anything like the national response to the strike that we're seeing today?
Like you said, it was a much smaller scale. And there, I want to say there were probably 20 to 25,000 teachers there that day. But like you said, it was nothing like it was today. I think that obviously social media has helped things. But this time, it's just, and I believe it's from the top down as far as what's going on in Washington and everything, is that they weren't as willing to work with us, and there was a lot of mansplaining going on and treating us like we didn't really know the law. And it was just a kind of more of a condescending attitude this time than it was in 1990.
You know, you sort of questioned, Radon, whether anything has really changed after that strike in 1990. I saw a figure saying that Oklahoma teachers' pay ranked 48th back then. Today it's 47th, which doesn't suggest a whole lot of progress.
Right, right. I think back then, actually, too, there again, we were more concerned about funding education and our students. And now, you know, we would like to not have to go check to check or worry or just barely survive. I mean, that's kind of what I'm just paycheck to paycheck. And I would like more pay. But at this point, we look at the bigger picture in Oklahoma is that we are educating all of our teachers to go to Texas or Arkansas, where they can walk in the door and make $10,000-$15,000 more a year. But education system in the state is imploding, and I don't understand why the people at the Capitol can't see that. And, you know, we're really concerned about keeping good educators in Oklahoma for our children. Besides everything else, I don't, you know, our border towns in Oklahoma are really suffering because people can go 5 minutes away, 10 minutes away, and make so much more money. So their teacher situation there is really, really bad.
Well, Radon, teachers here got a $6,000 pay raise on average, an increase in the education budget of about $50 million. But I have to say, as I listen to you talk about the history of this, you don't sound like a person who's terribly confident that this is going anywhere positive.
Well, I think that it's a start, but unless it's put into law that they have to work with this on year two and three, that it will be the same thing all over again. The great positive thing that has come out of this is I know on the first day that 458 people filed for office. And so if they're not going to pass the bills that we need, then we need to get them out of office. So I do feel like that's a huge positive right there. You know, I'm optimistic, but yet I am cautious too. And I think the tide is changing, thank goodness, and through the people running for office, and it'll take a little bit longer, but we have some other things up our sleeves, so hopefully we'll see some of this come into play. I think I'm a pretty sensible person, and like a lot of people out there, we just don't understand why they don't see why funding education is so important for any type of growth in your state.
Radon Musgrove, early childhood education teacher in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Ms. Musgrove, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Over the last few years, there's been an explosion in at-home genetic testing. Direct-to-consumer genetic testing company 23andMe reports having more than 5 million customers now. And according to Ancestry DNA, roughly 7 million people have taken their tests. Are you one of them?
Bob from Escondido, California.
Nan Holcomb, calling from Seattle, Washington.
Hi, I live in San Francisco, California.
Rhonda, and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. I sent my DNA into Ancestry.com. I'm African-American, and I have very limited information about my family prior to the migration from the South to the Northwest. So it was great to learn details about where my family came from in Africa and to connect with third and fourth cousins I never knew I had. I also learned where my reddish-brown hair and freckles come from.
I found out that I'm half Jewish and have a father I never knew about. Big surprises for me.
Considering my entire life, I had been told that I was quarter Cherokee Indian, and we were card-carrying members of the Cherokee Nation. It was quite a surprise when I did the genealogy test and found out that I was, in fact, 98% Northern European and 2% Sub-Saharan African. When I presented my family with the information, they just flat out denied it and said it was wrong.
I found my birth family through a DNA match on an online service. I was absolutely flabbergasted to see that one of my cousins and I could be twins. And looking at a picture of him was the first time I ever saw my face looking back at me.
Consumers are flocking to these tests to learn about distant relatives and family origins. Pharmacist Julie Kennerly-Shaw and her husband ordered the test from 23andMe back in July of 2016.
We were just dating at the time and thought that it would be a fun thing to do together. We were looking for the fun answers, such as, you know, what is your ancestry? Are you more or less likely to be an elite athlete? Those types of responses, in addition to any actionable health items that may have arose.
Julie and her husband also uploaded their data to a third-party site, Prometheus. And that's where the story shifts from family origins to those actionable health items that Julie was talking about there. Prometheus is a company that analyzes DNA for disease risks. And when they got their initial results back, there was nothing out of the ordinary. But months later, during a medical mission trip in Africa, they logged back in.
And at that time, I had two actionable items that were considered high severity. One of those was for Lynch syndrome. And Lynch syndrome is something that I've had a significant experience with at the James Cancer Hospital, because it does put you at a much greater risk for having colon cancer and also ovarian cancer. I was more nervous about my offspring. I think my husband was definitely more concerned that, hey, wait a minute, this means you have an 80% chance in a lifetime of developing colorectal cancer. And so he was really concerned about my health and wanted to make sure that I was seen by a genetics counselor as soon as possible to determine next steps.
Julie met with a genetics counselor from James Cancer Hospital, where she works, and got her results reanalyzed. And when the new results came back, they were negative. The Prometheus results had been a false positive. The experience was unsettling for Julie and her husband, but she says that at least her medical expertise worked to her advantage in this case.
I knew exactly who to contact and felt extremely fortunate that I knew someone who specialized in genetics and Lynch syndrome specifically, that worked at the place that I worked, and felt very comfortable emailing her directly right away and getting an appointment set up. And so I certainly think having a knowledge of the healthcare system worked to my advantage and my ability to navigate kind of the aftermath of the initial positive result.
So in Julie's case, she had quite a bit of medical knowledge. She could handle all of the information coming at her. But how should consumers who don't have that type of medical expertise approach these genetic tests? We're going to talk to an expert about that next. We also reached out to 23andMe for comment on this story, and a spokesperson told us, "We are extremely confident in the accuracy and of the detailed results we provide to our customers. Our standard for accuracy is unmatched in the market, since 23andMe is the only consumer company to undergo FDA authorization, showing our test to be over 99.9% accurate. As we clearly state in our product, we do not recommend customers take 23andMe's raw, uninterpreted data to other third-party sites, as we cannot account for the accuracy of those services." Dr. Gail Jarvik is a professor of medicine and genome sciences and head of medical genetics at the University of Washington. She spoke with me about some of the differences between clinical genetic tests and recreational genetic tests like the ones that Julie Kennerly-Shaw took.
23andMe is now offering
in addition to their ancestry and find your relative services, some medical information. And that medical information is risk of some genetic diseases. There are risks of Alzheimer's is one of the possibilities, hemochromatosis. More recently, they've added breast cancer, but only variants that are common in the Ashkenazi Jewish population. So that test as offered is not really relevant for people who are not of Ashkenazi ancestry, which is something we find that people don't understand when they order the test.
So then a lot of this goes to not only the volume of information and counseling that people get when they get results of these tests, but also the quality of that information. What do you have to say?
Well, my concern is that people don't really understand what they're ordering and they don't understand the results when they get them. And that's the bigger problem. In general, I'm very much a free the data person, and I think people have the right to their own genomic information. But our experience is that people don't understand what they're buying. And we have particular concerns for people who have a family history of disease who should really seek medical care to make sure they get the exact right test. And then on the flip side, people who were very upset to hear they have an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease when there's not a lot you can do to lower that risk. And again, they didn't really understand what they were purchasing. So they purchased, you know, concern and worry.
Right. So, Dr. Jarvik, we're getting lots of context and facts from you today. You know, genetic counseling is a very well-developed field. Of course, genetic counselors operate right along with what you do in your clinical and research work. Are there any of the principles of risk communication or genetic counseling operating in this industry right now? Or is it just a matter of pouring genetic tests back onto a consumer? You tested positive for this breast cancer gene, and then they have to come to you at your office or a dinner party to find out what it means.
Yeah, there's very little genetic counseling that will happen through these companies simply because they have such a large scale business. And genetic counseling, frankly, is expensive. And so at the cost of these tests, you know, really thorough genetic counseling that contextualizes the result for you and your family is not part of the package. And that if you have a test that raises a real health concern, coming to a medical professional is going to be needed, and, you know, health insurance or out-of-pocket payment to cover that is going to be needed. It's something in genetics that matters for your entire family, not just for the person who had the test. So there's a lot more information that has to be gained. And as you say, I think a lot of people aren't aware of genetic counseling as a profession. These are individuals who are board certified, who have master's level training in communicating genetic information to families. And it is a very important service for people who have genetic disorders. Unfortunately, there's a shortage of genetic counselors and genetics physicians nationally. And so one thing we're trying not to do is be flooded by people who just want their recreational genetics results explained to them.
Well, Dr. Jarvik, you're a clinician, not a bureaucrat, but do you think more regulation is needed here?
I think more education is probably needed here. I think that people need to understand what they're buying and they need to understand the results that they're getting and what the limitations are. I think the companies aren't really interested in telling you a lot about the limitations because it makes their product less valuable. So, you know, I can't speak to regulation, but, you know, I think education is something that is really important in this field.
Dr. Gail Jarvik, Professor of Medicine and Genome Sciences at the University of Washington. Dr. Jarvik, great to have you.
Thank you.
How small I look, laid out flat, my stomach touching ground, my right knee bent, and my brand new Nike stained with blood. I stoop and stare at my face, my right cheek flattened on concrete. My eyes are wide open. My mouth, too. I'm dead.
That's what you learn on the very first page of Jewel Parker Rhoades' new novel, Ghost Boys.
I thought I was bigger, tough, but I'm just a bit of nothing. My arms are outstretched like I was trying to fly, like Superman. I'd barely turn, sprinting. Pow! Pow! Two bullets. Legs gave way. I fell flat, hard. I hit snowy ground.
Ghost Boys chronicles the life, the death, and the afterlife of Jerome, a 12-year-old African-American boy killed by a police officer who believes he has a gun. Turns out, it was only a toy. The premise of this story could have been a real-life headline in any news outlet over the last few years, but Rhodes wrote this book for kids, middle graders who she says see the violence around them and have the power to respond to it.
It is a very emotionally intense novel, but one of the things is I think we have to do is not patronize kids. Kids know a lot more about what's going on in the world than sometimes we give them credit for. Also, I had the personal experience of having an 8-year-old at a school visit ask me, why do white people hate black people so much? So if there are 8-year-old children of color who are worried about the deaths of black boys, who are worried that they might die, then I felt it was something we needed to address, that we needed to talk about it in order to find a safe space for children to discuss with parents, to discuss with teachers, to discuss within their community. But I also think that there's ways in which by beginning the novel with Jerome is dead, it puts the emphasis on what is the other journey. If he's dead, why is he still around? What is he supposed to do? And that becomes very clear, I think, that Jerome is there to tell a story, that he is there to do good in the world and to have others be able to feel his presence, and in particular have Sarah, the white police officer's daughter, be able to see and hear him, and that Sarah is going to be able to carry his story forward. Sarah will become the group of children that will make the world we live in better. I think for me, death has been always part of my community. African Americans have the phrase, every goodbye ain't gone, meaning that even when you become spirit, your presence is still there. So I think death is, and maybe we make the presumption that death is scary to children, but I don't think that they would really see it that way, particularly when they start with the entryway point of a young boy, 12 years old, who's talking to them and saying, let me tell you my story.
Well, let's talk about that young boy for a moment. Let's talk about Jerome. He's 12, as you mentioned. In the opening scene, he's dead. Jerome was holding a toy gun and a police officer shot him. The police officer later tells the court that he thought this 12-year-old boy was a hulking, scary man with a weapon. And that narrative, that story, isn't make-believe. That sounds like a dozen cases that I've heard over the last couple of years. It sounds like a young boy playing with a toy gun in a park in Cleveland.
Oh, yes. I was very much inspired in a good way as an artist, and then horrified as a human being at the death of Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old playing with a toy gun. And so Jerome sort of has echoes of Tamir's life. Jerome resonates that Cleveland story. And one of the things that's interesting about social media is that you can actually see, and I think this is another reason why we shouldn't patronize kids, you can go to the internet and see Tamir Rice being shot and falling to the ground. It's utterly, utterly horrific. But in terms of psychology and social sciences, it has been proven that there is still in our racial consciousness, this bias that children, particularly children of color, aren't innocent, that somehow or another in people's minds they become criminalized and they do see them as bigger than they are, as men rather than children. They also see them as being more sexually assertive, which is, oh my God, that goes back to, you know, the Birth of a Nation in 1915, you know, so that these visions that some people have of black children have really dire consequences. And yet it all goes back, in my view, to the overt racism of slavery, that America still has the sin of slavery in its culture. And there are threads that have mutated to maybe less conscious racism, but there's still an unconscious bias that we've got to pluck out. It's almost as though we are being influenced by culture to see what isn't there, for the police officer to see, you know, what's not there in terms of an innocent child. And I want us to stop. I believe that children can help us see better. Well, they'll take that extra moment, that extra space to think, am I fearful because this person is a different color? Am I fearful because I think there's some reflection of a stereotype that I have? Or are they just like me, a person with a heart, a soul, and a mind?
Those stereotypes, those prejudices won't go away overnight. They won't go away even over the course of one generation if they're 400 years in the making. Can this book help immunize children to all those other influences in their lives that may point them toward even that unconscious prejudice that you're talking about?
Oh, Todd, I hope so very much. I think that is why I really wrote the book. And one of the things about this process of Jerome bearing witness to his tale, and me as a writer bearing witness to this pain, is to expunge those hard emotions, to expunge that horror, and add in that component of critical thinking, add in that component of empathy, add in the component of love. And I do believe children can be immunized. One of the things is this subject matter is really resonating with teenagers. I decided to write for a younger audience because I think middle schoolers are right on that wonderful cusp of becoming young adults. And they are filled with so much love and light, you know, and compassion. And so I wanted to make sure that they had a reminder to keep that no matter what, before the influences become stronger that might point them towards racial bias.
Jerome, in your story, is visited by a guide, sort of a version of himself, tragically, from earlier in American history, one of the ghost boys. He's visited by Emmett Till. And I read that you actually debated including some of the details of Emmett Till's story in your book.
Yes, I did. Emmett Till's death, his murder, was absolutely horrific. His mother showed courage in that she said, I want the world to see what they have done to my boy. And the images of Emmett Till actually sparked the civil rights movement. The images of Emmett Till made him seem so inhuman because he had been battered and abused so badly. So my novel doesn't go into sort of the graphic visual depiction, but it does go into the scene where you see the conflict of two adults attacking, hurting, and killing Emmett. And to me, no adult for any reason should ever hurt, harm, or abuse a child. And yet we know it happens. And in this historic case, it happened. And through the courage of Emmett's mom, we were able to use it to help make the world better. I find it appalling that, you know, all these decades later, we are still echoing, you know, this need to make the world better as it relates to racism. But you can say from Emmett Till's death, which was clearly racism, to maybe the death of a Tamir Rice, which might have been unconscious racial bias, that there has been a progression. But unfortunately, that doesn't really matter when the result is the same, when a child is murdered. I'd also like to say that in writing the Emmett scene, I first wrote it relying on the research that existed, you know, in books and on the internet. And all of that research suggested in some way that Emmett might have been responsible for his own death, if you can believe that. Some say he had a wolf whistle. He whistled in a sexually provocative way. Some say that he touched and assaulted Miss Bryant. Some say he said, hey, baby, that he was being slang and inappropriate with Mrs. Bryant. And so I had trouble writing that into the scene, because I couldn't believe that a 14-year-old boy would respond in any sexually suggestive way to an adult woman. And yet there it was in everything. Well, when the book was in copy editing, Mrs. Bryant, at the age of 82, finally confessed that she had lied on the stand, had lied, you know, to the media, had lied to the entire world. And she said, that boy didn't do anything to die for. And so I called my novel back and I rewrote that scene, and it felt so good to know that my instinct that he was an innocent boy, innocent child, was true, and it was confirmed.
Why so important to include Emmett Till in Jerome's journey in the first place? I mean, adults, hopefully, if they've studied a little bit of American history, know something about Emmett Till's death and what it meant, what his mother's decisions meant to the civil rights movement and to an American reckoning, although a belated one. But why so important to include him here?
I believe the historical context gives young men of color a better understanding for how they are being victimized. Now, just imagine that 8-year-old that I met in Shreveport, Louisiana, who said, why do white people hate us so much? You know, and my explanation to him would be because of an historical legacy. And it's important to understand that historical legacy because it's not you. You want to say, it's not you, baby. I want to hug you. It's not you. And I think there are a lot of kids of color who feel that something is wrong with them, that somehow they are deserving of this mistreatment. You know, it would make sense. There are these adults as well as, you know, others who perceive them as threatening. My book says to those boys, no, it is not you. You know, in an historical context, the sin is in the person who is looking at you in a negative light. But you have grace. You are wonderful. And I think a lot of kids don't have that historical context. Schools have stopped teaching slavery as in-depth as perhaps we should have it. And schools sometimes don't have enough time to talk about the civil rights movement. So this book gives them another way to understand it's not in me something that's wrong, but something in wrong that's created this landscape where people can see me as hurtful and harmful when I'm not.
Well, Emmett Till can see Jerome in this story, and that makes sense because they're both ghosts. There's only one live person in this story who can see Jerome too, and she's Sarah. She's a young white girl. She's the daughter of the police officer who killed Jerome. Why is Sarah in this story, and why is it important for her to see Jerome?
Sarah makes it possible for me to humanize the police officer's family and the police officer himself. One of the first rules of writing is that you have to love all your characters. And also, I would say that's a great rule for living one's life. My grandmother taught me, she said, honey, if somebody stereotypes you, you must never ever stereotype them in turn. So I wanted to show Sarah as a child coming of age and recognizing that her father isn't innocent, that her father has made a horrible mistake, but that doesn't mean that she should stop loving him. And it also means that Sarah has the power to change the world. I like it when Jerome asks Emmett, who first saw you? And he says, Thurgood Marshall. And for me, Sarah's like that. Why can't Sarah be Thurgood Marshall? You know, why can't a book filled with multi-ethnic kids show that they all can be heroes in terms of telling the story? But I love, love, love Sarah. And I also was surprised that Jerome was so compassionate towards her. There were ways in which Jerome led me into the light. Because at the very end of the book, Jerome, you know, says, well, Sarah knows my story. Sarah's going to work for equity, social justice. You know, Sarah is a good person. And clearly she must be, because she can see him, that her heart is already petal open in a wondrous kind of way. But Jerome then doesn't leave. And I kept wondering, why won't this character leave the book now? And finally, Jerome says to Sarah, "Sarah, talk to your dad." And Sarah goes, she talks to her dad. They say, "I love you." They hug each other. And she says, "Dad, will you help me with my project about racial injustice?" And the father says, "Yes." So the compassion of Jerome to say, "Yes, your father made a horrific, horrific mistake, but you guys are living. Don't waste it. Love. Do something. Bear witness." And I was just floored by that. And I think it was that sentiment of Jerome's that helped me get to the other side. Writing this novel was as cathartic for me as anything that I've ever done in my entire life. I was 1 year old when Emmett Till died, and maybe that's why he's there, that he was sort of like an opening to my life as a young Black woman. I've experienced, you know, horrific prejudices, you know, been called all kinds of horrific names. I had a son who was 2 when Rodney King was battered by police officers, and 4 officers were not convicted of a wrongful arrest, and riots happened. And every day I worry about my son when he goes out the door, what's going to happen to him? And in particular, and this too fits in with our society today, that when school children of color perhaps, you know, get into any kind of trouble, the police are more likely to be called than for the school officials to handle it. So we have a school to prison pipeline. Well, my son was a teenager, and all of a sudden the world started changing in how they saw him. And they were seeing him not as this wondrous young man, but instead as this hulking, threatening young man. And he was upset at school one day, and the maintenance worker called the dean of students, and the dean of students called me, and I walked over to the school to see Evan to find out, you know, what's wrong. He wasn't threatening. He wasn't doing anything that was any sense that he was going to hurt anybody. He was just having his teenage angst and very emotional. But I'll never forget that this maintenance worker said, "Next time, I'm going to call the police." And I was so scared, so scared. And I had to call my husband to say, you know you're 3,000 miles away, but you have got to come home. I am so scared, because I witnessed with a blink of an eye that, you know, one more instance or one little second, things could have gone very, very wrong. Just like a young man in California who has a cell phone, all of a sudden things go very, very wrong and he's shot by the police. It's hard raising children of color. It's hard. You worry all the time.
You worry all the time when your son walks out the door.
Yes, yes. And I know that my parents in raising me worried for me. Also, I'm a grandmother now, and I love being a grandmother. Clara is 17 months old, and I felt while writing this book, I felt my own mortality. I really expected by the time I had grandchildren, that so many things would be better. And certainly in terms of the isms of the world, the sexism, the racism, we would have made so much more progress. So now my time is running out, and I'm writing this clarion call to children. Live and make the world better. It is the children in middle school today who in 6 short years will be voting and changing the world. They will have the impact on Clara's life much more than I will have any impact.
Professor Rhodes, you talk about bearing witness and some of your motivations for writing this book in the afterword section at the end of Ghost Boys. I wonder if you'd read that for us now.
Even though Jerome is dead, throughout the course of the novel, his voice changes because his experiences change. And one of the things that I didn't know is that Jerome was going to end his story with a spoken word poem. that Jerome was going to say his last words. Bear witness, my tale is told. Wake, only the living can make the world better. Live and make it better. Don't let me or anyone else tell this tale again. Peace out, Ghost Boy. By signing his name Ghost Boy, he has now joined, you know, the community of all the boys that have been murdered and killed because of racism and or racial bias. And one of my favorite scenes in the book is that when Jerome realizes that he belongs to this community, he lifts his head to the sky and a keening wail comes out of his body, just waves and waves of pain. And there's the image of all the other ghost boys doing the same, saying, "Not fair, not fair, I die too soon." All of us who are living at this moment in time, all of us that are taking a breath, if we don't make good use of our days, we are dishonoring all those people throughout time in history who never had a chance to continue living, to live out their days. So what excuse do we have for not making the world better, for not finding joy, for not giving love, you know? So wake up, people. Wake up, America. Let's make it better, because we're still breathing, we're still alive, we're still here.
Professor Jewel Parker Rhodes, author of Ghost Boys, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It was my honor.
You can hear my extended conversation with Jewel Parker Rhodes on our website at thetakeaway.org. Ghost Boys is out tomorrow. And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. How do you photograph victims of war as more than just victims?
One of the limitations or the failings of photojournalism is that we so often are pushed to represent people at their most vulnerable and their most distressed.
British war photographer Anastasia Taylor-Lind focuses her lens on survival. That's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.